Well, good afternoon. It's nice to see so many people. I was thinking as I was sitting down there coming in and seeing, not seeing so many people, the first thing I noticed was the noise level was somewhat elevated, and I commented to somebody that either we have more people here or louder people, one or the other, but that was nice. But I thought back to several years ago when Shelby and Arlene and Brad and I were the only ones at service one day. Remember that? So we went ahead anyway. We had a study. But this is wonderful. Also wanted to mention, Shelby didn't want to say it. For some reason, she didn't want to say it last week, but I emailed many of you. She found a lump, which I think here, not on her breast, but near it. She's had some that come and go. She's at that age where it just seems to happen a lot, I guess. But this one here, because of whatever they discovered when they looked at it, they wanted to have a biopsy, which she's going to have on January 14th. So she's obviously concerned and requesting prayers, and we would appreciate that. Obviously, she's very concerned. She tends to be that way. So it's God can give her, pray that God would give her peace in her mind, too. She seems to be doing pretty well, considering all. And right now, she doesn't really know if she has anything to worry about or not. So it's slightly uncomfortable for her. But like I said, she's had things like that before that have turned out to not be a problem. Now, today I'm going to read some stories that may or may not be interesting to you. We'll see. I'm just going to read one first here, and then you'll get an idea where I'm going. This is from historyworld.net. That's one of the resources I use. I use some other historical resources. The story begins, like so many others, with a gaping emptiness, chaos. Within this, there emerges Gaia, the earth. Gaia gives birth to a sun, Uranus, who's the sky. The world now exists, earth and heaven, and together Gaia and Uranus provide it with a population, their children. First, Gaia produces the Titans, the heroic figure of both sexes, but next, her next offspring are less satisfactory, the Cyclops. With only one eye in the middle of their foreheads, are followed by unmistakable monsters with a profusion of heads and arms. Uranus, appalled by his offspring, shuts them all up in the depths of the earth. Gaia's maternal instincts are offended. She persuades the youngest Titan, Cronus, to attack his father. He surprises him in his sleep and with a sharp sickle cuts off part of his body, which I won't identify, and throws into the sea. Cronus frees his brothers and sisters from their dungeon, and together they continue to populate the world. But in an inability to get along with their offspring characterizes the males of this clan. Cronus, who has six children with his sister Rhea, eats each of them as soon as it was born. Once again, maternal instincts intervene. To save her youngest child, Rhea wraps a stone in swaddling clothes. Cronus swallows the bundle, he swallows the stone, and Rhea sends her baby to foster parents. He is Zeus. Now you finally, somebody you recognize. He is Zeus. As an adult, he overwhelms his father, defeats all the other Titans in a great war, and then settles upon Mount Olympus to preside over a world which has at last achieved a certain calm. During this, imperceptibly, mankind has arrived on Earth. It's not clear how, but men are certainly there because a free-thinking Titan, Prometheus, smuggles them the valuable gift of fire. These first men are not considered direct ancestors by most Greeks, and there are several versions of how the present race of humans originated. One is that Zeus, exasperated by Prometheus, sends a flood to drown mankind. Two humans escape in an ark. When the flood has subsided, the oracle at Delphi tells these two to cast behind them the bones of their first ancestor. That ancestor, they reason, is Gaia, the earth, so they throw stones over their shoulders, and from each stone, a human being is created. Well, that's one story. I want to read another one. The Japanese story of creation leads not so much to the first man. Actually, I don't want to read that one, do I? Yeah, I'll read it. As to the first emperor. Not surprisingly, since legends are collected and written down early in the 8th century A.D. by command of the imperial family, eager to establish a direct link back to the gods. It transpires that the gods have a lengthy and complex existence before we reach the emperor. The story begins with a floating amorphous mass, similar to the slithery substance of an egg, but moving more like a jellyfish. From this there emerges a reed-like object that produces eight generations of brother and sister gods. The eighth pair of gods are Izanagi, I guess pronounce it, that's the male who invites, and Izanami, the female who invites. Standing on the floating bridge of heaven, they lean down to stir the brine of the sea with a lance. The liquid begins to curdle and forms an island. The two gods come down to it and build a central pillar. Behind this, they come together in a delightful passage of divine innocence to try to create more islands and gods. Their first products are flawed. A child which can't stand by the age of three, an island that's composed of foam. This turns out to be because the woman spoke first in their encounter. With due formality established, they create many gods, including those of the eight islands of Japan. The gods proliferate. Soon there are 8 million. And they have many dramatic adventures, establishing such basic patterns of life as day and night, summer and winter. Eventually, the sun goddess sends her grandson, Ninigi, to rule the central land of the reed plains. This is Japan. Ninigi is granted three treasures as a symbol of his rule, a jeweled necklace, symbolizing benevolence, a mirror for purity, and a sword for courage. His great-grandson, Jimmu Tennō, is listed in Japanese legend as the first emperor. A necklace, mirror, and sword are still in the Japanese imperial symbols, kept in an inner sanctuary of Shinto shrines. Okay, now I'm going to read Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, from the King James, God created the heavens and the earth, or the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And evening and morning were the first day. You're very familiar with that. Skip all the way to verse 27, where we, verse 26, where we read that after the earth is all formed and lights are in the heavens for seasons and so forth, and we have animals and we have birds and we have creeping things and we have plants and land and ocean and sky. Verse 26, God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. And there are more details in the couple of chapters that follow. Most all countries, or cultures, I should say, and religions have a creation story. How things came to be. Why is the world the way it is? Some are more complex than others. Some are more intended to be taken literally, or maybe less intended to be taken literally than others. As people of the book, and that's what we are, we're people of the book. We believe what's in this book because we're Christians. Jews are people of the book, or at least part of this book. Muslims are people of the book, this book, and more specifically the Quran. And all people of the book have a common approach to creation. We may disagree on other points, maybe some few or many other points, but in general we believe the same creation account. What I'd like to do today is to look at some other creation accounts. I've just read two of them, but I'm going to look at some more. And I want to compare them to the book of Genesis. And what I'd like to do, and the reason I'd like to do this, is to back up a little bit. Sometimes I think I know speaking for myself, I can get involved in lots of little details about how I disagree with you about this and how I disagree with you about this. And maybe I agree with you on something else. But if we step way back, we have some big disagreements, huge disagreements, with a large portion of the world on how things came to be, where the world came from. And when you think about, again, the big picture, that God is interested that all men come to salvation, what truths do these people need to hear? They need to hear a lot of truth. What do they need to hear? What is it they're missing because of their particular culture has this view of how the world came to be, or their particular religion has another view of how the world came to be? What are they missing? That's what I'd like to explore today. I've never thought about these things so much in this way, just recently reading Genesis, and it came to mind, and also because of having been in Asia a few months ago, realizing that the people there come from an entirely different background, an amazingly different background than I do, because of their culture and where they were born and where they live and what their local religions are. I need to caution everybody, I'm not an expert in world religions. I'm not pretending to be a professor here. I will perhaps at least follow the Google example of doing no harm. I want to speak correctly. But unlike Google, I'm not linked into all sources of knowledge. So I don't know everything about this, but I'm confident that what I am telling you is true. But I don't pretend when I read a creation story or describe one, that's not the be-all and the end-all, and you could look at a different resource and come up with a slightly different version of the story. That should go without saying. And I would also say in advance that I will share my viewpoints about some of these stories and how they compare with the Bible. That might be my own opinions. Other people may disagree. You may disagree, but at least it'll be obvious what are my opinions from, and my feelings will be based on the scripture that we all believe. First of all, who is the rest of the world? I think this would be interesting to paint a picture at first. According to the CIA fact book, the latest figures they had that I was able to access were in 2004, the latest ones I was able to access. Christians, people that believe in Jesus and this creation account here, make up about a third of the world. About a third. What? How many people are in the world now? I didn't look that up. Anybody know? How many people, approximately? Nobody? I can't hear. Is it six? I didn't necessarily. I thought it was six, but I'm not. Now, who's counting? You know, so, yeah, it grows all the time. That's what I thought, six, but I didn't want to say that. So about a third or 2 million or 2 billion people on earth are Christians in their nominal religion, you know, what they claim to follow. About 20% of the world, or 1,200,000, are Muslim. About 13% are Hindu. I'm not going to try to calculate what 13 would be, so what, 780? Million. Buddhists make up about 6%. Other religions make up about another 13%. No religion at all, don't claim any religion, about 12%. So what we have is between Christians and Muslims and Jews, which is a very, very small number, we have a little over half of the world believes basically in the account that's in this book about how the world came to be. So we've got half of the rest of the world that don't believe it. And truth be told, a large percentage of the half that believe the book don't really believe the book. Right? I mean, you know, they claim to be, we say we're Christian, but we may not believe exactly, well, that Genesis is just a story, just like these other stories. You could believe that. I could believe that. Or lots of people who call themselves Christian could believe it. But at least nominally, by the religion that they claim to be a part of, they claim to believe the book, or at least they're familiar with the story, and it's part of their culture. But for half of the people in the world, that's not even part of their culture. And yes, there's a whole lot of truth that they need to hear, including that Jesus is the Messiah, and that, you know, that they need to be saved from their sins and the whole message of the gospel. That's not what this sermon's about. This talk here will be about creation and how we came to be. And what I'd like to do, as I said, is step back, get a big picture, and maybe get yourself in their shoes a little bit. What are they thinking? What is their approach? And how does this affect their worldview? And how they look at what we believe? And how they might look at somebody who's very Western like we are, that's trying to tell them about God. So that's the purpose of going through this. And also to maybe shore up our own belief system, to look at it in maybe a different way than you have, because you take it for granted. Yeah, go back to Genesis, there it is. But when you think about that half of the world doesn't believe that at all, isn't even familiar with it, doesn't have a clue about that, it may make you look at it a little bit differently. I hope it does. And I'd like to share with you some of the creation stories. And as we go through, I'd like you to think about how they contrast with what's written in the Bible. And what's different. And why that difference might be important. And I'll hopefully remember to ask for your input from time to time. I want to read a summary here from the Encarta, which is the Microsoft Encyclopedia. Creation stories, or myths, that explain the origin of the universe or cosmos. Actually, you'll find that many of them don't. The origin of the cosmos forms one of the principal themes of mythology throughout the world. Most mythologies view the process of creation as belonging to the distant past. Some mythological traditions, however, present creation as a continuing cycle of birth and destruction, such as Hinduism and some Central American religions. Students of mythology, this is, I think, important, often draw a distinction between creation myths proper, or cosmogonies, and myths of origins. Cosmogonies tell how the cosmos arose or was created from a primal state. Myths of origin explain how later features of the known world, such as human beings, animals, and the social order, came into being. In practice, however, the stories of origin usually represent continuations of cosmogony, recounting further development of an original creative act. What I found when I researched this, and I took a comparative religions course many years ago in a local community college, is that a lot of the creation accounts, the creation stories, don't really get into where it all came from. They just discuss how the social order came to be, because that seemed to be what mattered. And perhaps I'll throw that out. That's one of the differences I found between these traditions, and maybe you'll see that as we go through with some of them. Here's what's interesting. Just to give you, I'm going to throw out some of the conclusions ahead of time because they're written in these summaries. But here's what the Encarta Encyclopedia says. Most creation stories assume the eternity of matter or even of the world itself. Now, I think that's very interesting, and I'm going to show you something later on in the sermon that shows how that affects even people in our own culture. Because our culture doesn't necessarily believe that. In fact, even scientifically, we don't believe it. We say, oh, there's a big bang. It all came from a space-time singularity, and all the matter of the universe was there. But we still presuppose that that matter was all there. So it's still still kind of, we kind of assume it was always there. We don't have an answer scientifically, but in this book, we have an answer. Some creation myths, I'm skipping down over some in the article. Some creation myths reflect the environmental circumstances of a particular culture. And I'll just leave it at that. We'll look at one. In fact, that's probably one of the first ones I want to look at. That sounds very local in its description. And I could have brought a lot of those, but I didn't. Typically, your tribal, you know, this tribe has a story, that tribe has a story. It's very local. The gods showed them how to use the particular instruments of agriculture that they use, or showed them how to herd animals, the particular animals that they have. A very local account of what the gods did. Other ones are more universal. Here's another account from History World. That resource, historyworld.net. All human societies, including our own, tell stories of how the world began. Such stories are almost infinitely varied in detail, but they tend to include some basic themes. I want to share these basic themes. Many accounts begin with the earth, or earth retrieved from water. In some of them, gods and people and animals emerge from the earth, just like plants still do. In others, the process begins with when a creature, such as a crab or a tortoise, dives into a primeval ocean and brings up a small piece of earth from which the universe is created. Now, I don't know about you. Does that make sense? How is it that part of the earth is used to create the universe? You know, it sounds like it's backwards. You need to have a universe first for the earth to be in. But these stories are not necessarily logical, and maybe they weren't intended to be originally. Myths of these kind are common among American Indians and Aboriginal Australians, who place before the moment of creation a certain period called the time of dreaming. Now, there are interesting, I thought interesting, stories. Talk about Big Bang. We have the scientists have the Big Bang. Well, thousands of years ago, they had similar versions. Continuing from the article, several mythologies, including one developed in China, begin with the splitting in two of a cosmic egg. In the Chinese version, this is followed by the growth of a giant whose limbs eventually form the observable world. A dismembered giant features also in the Germanic or Norse account of creation. And that's all I'll read from there. There are several stories, I think I'll read one, where there's an egg, and everything comes from the egg. And in one of them, which I'm not going to read, it even talks about how when the egg breaks, explodes, whatever happens, that everything moves away from the egg. Everything, the universe, if you want to call it that, expands from the egg. And that's exactly what modern astronomers believe, that the universe is expanding from this center of where it all started with the Big Bang. So that's interesting. Some of these things haven't changed for thousands of years. Here's another thing. Well, I don't want to read this. I want you to notice it when we read through the stories. I don't want to read this summary. Let's look at some. And I hope I don't bore you with the reading. I'll try to make it interesting. These are kind of fun, fun for me anyway. I'll try to share that fun. In Kenya, where hopefully things are returning a little bit more to normal, but the Maasai people that are the indigenous, one of the indigenous tribes in Kenya, their creation narrative recounts the origin of humanity to be fashioned by the creator deity from a single tree or leg which split into three pieces. To the first father of the Maasai, he gave a stick. To the first father of the Kikuyu, that's one of those tribes that's the tribe that has the power now, right? He gave a hoe. To the first father of the Kamba, he gave a bow and arrow. Each son survived in the wild. The first father of the Maasai used his stick to herd animals. The first father of the Kikuyu used his hoe to cultivate the ground. The first father of the Kamba used his bow and arrow to hunt. So here's a creation story, if you want to put it that way, that is very local in its flavor. The gods gave this tribe the ability to herd animals. They gave this tribe the ability to be good hunters. They gave this tribe the ability to be good agricultural people. It doesn't have anything to say about how the rest of the world came to be. In their particular worldview, it didn't matter. What mattered is how the particular tribes in their area came to be the way they are, or the way they were when the story came about. And there are others, like I said, I could have brought in South and Central America, the American Indians, some of the South South American Indians and other indigenous tribes to some of the in Africa have stories very similar to that. Now, when we read in Genesis, chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." It doesn't start local at all. It says everything. And that's quite a difference. It's quite a difference. It's not a quantitative difference. It's not a matter of counting beans here. It's qualitative. It's entirely different. Some creation accounts just talk about how things got organized in the local level. You know, what we believe talks about how it all came to be. And it's very different. Some stories, I am sure, were never intended to be taken literally. They're just analogies that are kind of cute, maybe to make a point. I say cute, maybe that's the wrong word, but I can't believe that educated human beings were supposed to believe these stories at face value. Some people would believe that, likewise, that how could I believe what I believe? So I guess fair is fair here. But here's one from China. Of various creation stories which evolve in China, the most striking is that of Panku. He's hatched from a cosmic egg. And you read this particular, anytime you read stories of creation, this one comes up because it's a famous one in China. Half the shell is above him as the sky. The other half below him is the earth. He grows taller each day. We've got to separate the sky from the earth, okay? Grows taller each day for 18,000 years, gradually pushing them apart till they reach their appointed places. After this effort, Panku falls to pieces. His limbs become the mountains, his blood the rivers, his breath the wind, and his voice the thunder. His two eyes are the sun and the moon. The parasites on his body are mankind. So maybe there's a lesson in there. I don't imagine that this story was intended to be taken literally. But again, it's a story. It's a story, and it explains something, how things came to be. The Mayan account down there in the eastern Mexico. Let me see if I can find that. It's, I think, a similar account that you really can't take. I don't imagine you're supposed to take seriously. I could be wrong. But the Mayan account. The Maya of Mesoamerica creation story is recounted in the book Popol Vuh, if I'm pronouncing that right. I don't know how to pronounce all these names. Tepu and Gucamatz came together to create the world. Whatever was thought of by Tepu and Gucamatz came into being. Next for creation are the creatures of the forest, birds, deer, jaguars, and snakes. They are told to multiply and scatter, and then to speak and pray to us. But the animals just squawk and howl. So Tepu and Gucamatz tried to make some respectful creatures from mud. But the results are not great, and they allow the new race to be washed away. They call upon their grandparents, who suggest wood as an appropriate medium. But the wooden people are just mindless robots. It's all kind of sounds current. So Tepu and Gucamatz set about the destruction of this new race by means of a rainstorm. This causes the animals to turn against the wooden people, even their pots and cairns rebel, and crush the people's faces. The wooden people escape to the forest and are turned into monkeys. Heart of Sky then make yet another attempt at creating a suitably respectful race and finally succeed in fashioning humans out of maize corn dough. I can't imagine that that's supposed to be taken literally. But even that particular account, it doesn't explain how things came to be, really. To me, it's not very satisfying. But maybe it wasn't intended to. I already read the story from Japan, and I just make the comment that particular story, remember, it's the one that showed that these couple of gods ended up making the islands and so forth, but things didn't work out too well till they realized that the man had to speak before the woman, then it worked out. Those people, that whole story ended up in there being an emperor. So that story is pretty obviously political, to show that the emperor is descended from the gods. Is it intended to be taken literally? Well, perhaps, but the main point is to show the authority of the ruling family at the time. And that's pretty obvious where that's coming from. There are some creation stories that are more complex than the ones I've just read. And I'd like to share a few of those, because there's more involved, and they try to cover more bases and explain more things. And perhaps because of that, they might be a little more interesting. Whether they answer more questions or not is another thing. Perhaps they'll raise questions. In Egypt, for instance, there are several creation stories attached to rival gods, rival deities. The most common one begins with Nun, the primeval ocean, from which Amman rises in splendor. He's one of the famous deities. So to make this accessible, I don't know how many of the younger ones are listening, but in other cultures, there are lots of beings that are called gods. And maybe I can call them deities. They're not God like we believe in a God, one God. There are many different gods. And these gods argue and fight with one another. They don't get along. And they're very much like people. And that's the way a lot of religions, a lot of mythologies go back into these gods, many, many gods, who act just like people, only maybe even worse. In Egypt, you have Amon, who rose in splendor. He takes the name Re, thus merging two rival deities. By a particular act that I won't go into, he produces a divine son and daughter. These two breed a race of gods. While the tears of Amun-Re, the combined god being now, become mankind. Appropriately enough, for man's behavior soon persuades the creator to withdraw from earthly affairs. He retires to the heavens, where he reigns as the sun. So that's fairly simple, but Egyptian mythology from that point gets to be very complex and very complicated. But you have the sun. You have the sun god. The sun god is a primary god in many, many of the mythologies. And they don't explain how the Son got there. They just, you have the Son God. If I can read about India a little bit, there are Indian creation myths. In keeping with the complexities of Hinduism, they range from familiar themes such as dismembered giants and magical eggs to the most delicately expressed doubts as to the possibility of knowledge on such a matter. In an early story, Purusha is a primal man sacrificed by the gods as to the act of creation. The sky comes from his head, the earth from his feet, the sun from his eye, and the moon from his mind. The four castes of Hindu society also derive from his body. The birds and animals come from the fat which drifts from him during the sacrifice. Now, again, how can you take this literally? How can there be a man who has a sacrifice and from which the sun and the moon come? How do you have a man, how do you have an earth and a man before you have a sun and a moon? These things don't really make sense. They're stories, but they don't do much for me anyway when I try to apply logic to them. A much later Indian story involves the god Brahma. Beginning from nothing, he goes through a lengthy process. First, he creates, by thought alone, the waters. This is sounding more familiar, perhaps. In them, he deposits his seed, which grows into a golden egg. Always got eggs in the story. He himself is born in the egg. After a year, again by thought alone, he splits the egg in two. The halves become, in the usual way, the heavens and the earth. So there's an example from India. And I could read lots and lots of these. I'll read one more, this one from the Norseland. So, like Greek mythology, I think in America we're more familiar with Norse mythology and Greek mythology than the rest of them. The main northern story of creation is probably shared by all the people forming one distinct part of the Indo-European family, the German tribes who gradually moved south through Europe from the shores of the Baltic. But it is in Scandinavia that the Germanic legends are eventually recorded and preserved in the stories of the Norse god. In other words, all these the people of northern Europe all believe the same thing, according to scholars, but they're called Norse legends, but the Germanic people also believed them originally. In the beginning, there is nothingness. Gradually, the space fills with water, which freezes and then partially melts. Again, it's a local flavor. It's cold up there, isn't it? It's cold, and we've had ice ages in the times of recorded history in Europe. So, and here you've got the story that involves things being very cold. From the drops of melting water, a giant in human form emerges. This is Ymir. From his armpit, a man and a woman appear, giants like himself, but capable of producing others by more conventional means. Meanwhile, a cow has licked the melting ice and revealed another giant, from whom the god Odin descends. Odin, like Wednesday. Odin and his brothers kill the aged Ymir. Of his flesh they make the earth, of his skull the heavens, of his blood the sea, of his bones the mountains, and of his hair the trees. Odin builds a place for himself and the other gods to dwell in, linked to earth by the bridge of the rainbow. And he arranges for the maggots in Ymir's corp, who have taken stunted human shape as dwarfs, to remain in what is now his body beneath the surface of the earth. On earth itself, Odin and his colleagues breathe life into two tree trunks, turning them into Ask and Embla, the first man and woman. So they've got a similar story there. I'll just share one more, which is kind of a non-story. Again, I was in Asia, most in very Eastern Asia, like Thailand. The people are mostly Buddhist. Buddhism is, I don't know a lot about Buddhism, but it doesn't necessarily impact their daily life and how they live. It can, if you approach it seriously. But Buddhism generally ignores the question regarding origin of life. The Buddha, regarding the origin of life, has said, conjecture about the origin of the world is an unconjecturable that need not to be conjectured about. That would bring madness and vexation to anyone who conjectured about it. So he didn't want to bother with it. And in regard to ignoring the question of the origin of life, the Buddha has said, and why are they undeclared by me? Because they are not connected with the goal, are not fundamental to the holy life. They do not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, calming, direct knowledge, self-awakening, and unbinding. That is why they are undeclared by me. So in Buddhism, it's not important, so they don't address it. And I'll skip some of that. So that was a whole bunch of stories there. Stories about how things came to be, how the world came to be, or how the social order came to be, or how man came to be. Did you pick up on any of that? We take all of those stories. What did those stories have anything in common? Did you pick up on anything that they had, those stories had in common, or that where they struck you? Leave you with any questions, or they're all somewhat similar, maybe didn't answer this question or whatever. Anybody want to share how they hit you? Yeah, several of things hit me. One is all the stories that I looked up, except for maybe one, assumed the preexistence of matter. There's already an earth or a universe or stuff or whatever. There's already things that you start with matter. And you may think that doesn't matter. Who cares? Well, Eastern religion, as opposed to the people of the book, God is in the matter. God is in the trees. God is in the animals. God's in the earth. He's everywhere. Or it is everywhere, whatever. So the thing that's transcendent, that goes back forever, is the earth, the sky, the sea. You know, it's the physical universe. And here's me talking, not the authorities. That's what they worship. I know they's a broad brush, but many of these types of religions are worshiping, when you get boil it down to the bottom line, they're worshiping the creation. And I asked Mike to look up where the scripture was, and it's in Romans 1 in verse 25, where it says, and I'll just read it. Now, he's talking about Greeks here, Paul is, but professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, verse 22, and in verse 23, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness. Verse 25, who has changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. So back then, this is a couple thousand years ago, Paul's addressing the world in which he lived, where the majority of people were not people of the book. All you had were the Jews there in his society that believed in the book. You didn't have any Muslims yet or Christian. Christianity was very brand new. So everybody else believed some other system. And I've read to you some of the examples of the stories that they believed and how things came to be. And one of the common denominators is the universe, the things, the creation was already there. And the story explained more like how it came to be organized, ordered. And some of them are even self-contradictory within themselves, that part of the earth is used to create the universe. You know, it doesn't make sense. It was a common feature of what I will title pagan religions, to worship the creation. And many of these creation stories that I've read to you show that. Because all the way down to the foundation, the gods, the deities, the multiple gods, seem to spring from the creation somehow and be subject to it. What's this book say? Says that God made it. And of course, you know, if you're inquisitive, you have young children and they say, well, where did God come from? I don't know how you answer that. I answered it three words. I don't know. God hasn't given us to understand that. As I've gotten older, I have some conjecture. Doesn't explain where God came from. It just, I feel now that time and space are characteristics of the universe that we in which we live, that God made. They're not characteristics of his existence. So that where he came from is a question that perhaps in his existence means nothing. We have to have a beginning. We have to come from somewhere. Because of the universe that we live in demands that. But that's where we live. That's not where God lives. And that question of where does God come from, probably, I'm suggesting, speculation, doesn't have any meaning. That question has no meaning in God's world, if you want to put it that way, in his existence. It's something that means something to physical people. It's a question we'd like to have answered because everything in our experience has a beginning, not God. Beginning is time, is a time-dependent question. So anyway, all these stories assume a pre-existence of matter. In fact, some of, I didn't read you details there, but some of the stories actually, there's a quote here I can find real quick, actually assume there has to be a world. There has to be a world. That's where you start. That's your foundation for everything. So why wouldn't you worship that? Another thing that I noticed, actually, and I read this too. I don't know where I read it now. But when you think about the origin of everything, and you have deities, and you have the earth, and you have somehow you're making one from the other, and you know back and forth, all these transference and so forth, and the battles between the gods, which I don't think I read too much about that. There's a confusion between physical and spiritual. The world's physical, but it always existed. So how is that? You know, the universe is winding down. It's running out. How could it always have existed as some physical creation? So there seems to be some confusion between what is eternal and what is not. Another thing that's common to these creation stories that's not in this book is that there are lots of deities. You have this god having an argument with the other god, and I don't know if I... Well, yeah, we had a little bit of that in the Greek legends. But you have disputes. I didn't read some of the details in one of them. Where this I should read that. No, I'll read that. There's a Mesopotamian one I'm still going to read with some details about battles between different deities, and they can kill each other. Well, again, what kind of a deity is that? Another thing that seemed odd to me as I went through these is that man seemed to be, to me, reading through these stories, seemed to be a byproduct. Seemed to be kind of like this was happening, the gods are fighting about this and they're doing that, and they're they're got their own little petty battles, and in the meantime, somehow or another, somebody throws a stone over their back and up comes man. You know, just kind of like, oh, by the way, we have human beings now. In fact, we had some that didn't work too well, and we replaced them. Now we got some good ones. And the wooden ones went out and became monkeys. It's kind of reverse evolution. And then we try again, make some new ones. Man doesn't seem to be part of the plan, seems to be an afterthought to me. That's the way it came across to me. I want to share one more. Now, I have a particular reason for wanting to share this one, because when you study into some of these kinds of things, and just doing your Bible study, you'll notice sometimes, maybe you've seen this, where a commentator will compare something that's in this book to the Epic of Gilgamesh, or something in Egypt, or in this case, the Enuma Elish, which is a Mesopotamian creation account. And they'll say, if I'll read this, let me just read something here. The Enuma Elish is the Babylonian or Mesopotamian creation epic. It was first discovered by modern scholars. They discovered fragments of it in the ruined library of Ashurbanipal in Nineveh, which is Nineveh is Mosul in Iraq. Recovered by Henry Layard in 1849, published by George Smith in 1876. The Enuma Elish has about 1,000 lines, and it's recorded in Akkadian on 7 clay tablets. I think they found another copy of it that wasn't on 7 tablets, each holding between 115 and 170 lines of text. The majority of tablet 5 has never been recovered, but aside from this, the text is almost complete. a duplicate copy of Tablet 5 has been found somewhere else. The Epic is one of the most important sources for understanding the Babylonian worldview. Now, Babylonia is where Iraq is. It's the cradle of civilization. It's where people say, yes, where Abraham came from. So the stories that are in this book by scholars are considered to have come from the same area. That's why this is significant. The Epic is one of the most important sources for understanding the Babylonian worldview, centered on the supremacy of Marduk and the existence of mankind for the service of the gods. Its primary original purpose, however, is not an exposition of theology or theogony, but the elevation of Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, above other Mesopotamian gods. So it had a political purpose here, to raise one particular god above the others and so ensure the power of whatever king was around at the time. The Enuma Elish has existed in various versions and copies from Babylonia as well as from Assyria. The version of Ashurbanipal's library dates to the 7th century BC. The story itself probably dates to the 18th century BC on account of the fact that this is the time when the god Marduk seemed to have a prominent status. I'm not going to read the entire thing here, but there are different deities involved again. And the Epic names three primeval gods, Apsu, the fresh water, Tiamat, the salt water, and their son Mumu, apparently the mist. Several other gods are created, including Ea and his brothers, who reside in Tiamat's vast body. So, again, the one god or goddess is the seas, so lots of things can live in her body in the seas. Apsu wishes to kill. Oh, wait a minute, I'm sorry. They make so much noise, these are the ones in the sea, that it annoys Tiamat and Apsu greatly. Now again, how seriously do you take this? Apsu wishes to kill the young gods, but Tiamat disagrees. The vizier, Mumu, agrees with Apsu's plan to destroy them. Tiamat, to stop this from occurring, tells this Ea that the time, who's at the time the most powerful of the gods, who, using magic, puts Apsu into a coma and kills him and shuts Mumu out. Ea then becomes the chief god, and along with the consort Damkina, has a son, Marduk, greater still than himself. Marduk is given wind to play with, and he uses it to make dust storms and tornadoes. This disrupts Tiamat's great body and causes the gods still residing in her to be unable to sleep. They persuade Tiamat to take revenge for the death of her husband. Her power grows. Some of the gods join her. She creates 11 monsters to help her win the battle and elevates Kingu, her new husband, to supreme dominion. A lengthy description of the other gods' inability to deal with the threat follows. This is all in Enuma Elish, okay? I want to read you something about that. This is what's amazing. This is how the story goes. They got the 11 monsters to help her win the battle. Her new husband is the supreme dominion. A lengthy description of the other gods' inability to deal with the threat follows. Ultimately, Marduk is selected as their champion against Tiamat and becomes very powerful. He defeats and kills Tiamat and forms the world from her corpse. The subsequent 100 lines or so constitute the law section of Tablet 5. The gods who sided with Tiamat are initially forced to labor in the service of the other gods. They are freed from their servitude when Marduk decides to slay Kingu, he's the one that was supposed to be in charge of everybody, and create mankind from his blood. Babylon is established as the residence of the chief gods. Finally, the gods confer kingship on Marduk, hailing him with 50 names. Most noteworthy is Marduk's symbolic elevation over Enlil, who was seen by earlier Mesopotamian civilizations as king of the gods. Okay, I could have read more detail from this story. That's just a typical story of all the deities fighting one another, and somehow or another that's going to result in the earth being the way it is. Yeah, now. Let me read. I could read more about this, but I'm just going to read one quote. While the Hebrew Bible is not based directly on the Enuma Elish, the dependence of at least some biblical creation text on a common ancient Near Eastern creation by combat and myth are not gainsayable. All right, that's kind of a complex statement. What they're saying is, and what other commentators say, is that it's almost without a doubt that the creation story in this book, the people of the book believe, is based on that thing I just read you. To me, that's insane. No criticism intended of the individual people who believe that, but, you know, to me it just cries of people that are determined somehow or another not to believe in the inspiration of this book. Now, that's not to say that there aren't similarities between how this book is written and how other books in the same part of the world were written at the same period of time. I don't have a problem with that. But to imply that the creation story that we read in Genesis is somehow based on this, I don't get it. Just because there are a couple of verses in this thing that seem to be similar. The whole story is about multiple gods who are in conflict that assume a creation is already in existence. All the things that I talked about before. It is in no way similar to this book that's sitting up here. Maybe in this verse or that verse, you might have a similarity. Yeah, we create plants before you create the animals that have to eat the plants. Okay, that's smart, whatever. But it doesn't prove that one was derived from the other. It doesn't even imply it to me. But other people can believe that, that's fine. I don't see it. Now, this is what amazed me. Comparisons between the Bible and other ancient Near Eastern texts are often obscured by English translations. Now, I think this is just out of Wikipedia, maybe. Let me just find it. Yeah. Who wrote this is indeterminate, but they did have some notations, and I looked some of them up, and I have an example to show you. Comparisons between the Bible and other ancient Near Eastern texts are often obscured by English translations, which impose on the Hebrew the Christian doctrines of creation ex nihilo, that is, creating something out of nothing, and of the Trinity. Thus, the opening of Genesis 1 is traditionally rendered, "In the beginning, God created both the heaven and the earth." Whereas the Hebrew makes it clear that Genesis 1:1-3 is describing the state of chaos immediately prior to God's creation. What are they saying? They're saying that the book that you and I believe in, and the creation account that you and I believe, is no different than the other creation accounts. There's already a world. There's already a universe. And God just sets about organizing it, just like in all these other stories. And the claim is that the Hebrew is clear on this. Well, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I can't comment on that from expert witness myself. I look at all the translations I have, and they had very knowledgeable people that did those translations, and they said that it said, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." But I did find one. This is interesting to me. This right here is the Jewish Publication Society, Holy Scriptures, from the Masoretic Text. It was completed, the translation work was completed in 1917. Okay? So here's a bunch of Jews that know Hebrew that translated this book. And it says, Genesis 1:1, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Now the earth was unformed and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light." Okay? Don't get too smug, because here I have Jewish Publication Society. This is kind of like we have Revised Standard Version, or we have the New English Bible, or the New American Standard. Here's the New JPS. It was, I don't know when it was started, it was completed in the, well, this version came out in 1988. Different parts of it were completed prior to that. And, yeah. 1917. And this also, I believe, is not strictly from the Masoretic Text. It includes the newer, I can put it, the supposedly older versions, the supposed more accurate versions. But of all the translations I have that I didn't look at every single one I had, but they all, in general, they say what the King James says. This one came out in my lifetime, Genesis 1, verse 1. When God began to create heaven and earth, the earth being unformed and void, with darkness over the face of the deep, and a wind from God sweeping over the water, God said, let there be light, and there was light. Well, you know, and there are two marginal notes, or other footnotes, and they say, others say, in the beginning God created others in the spirit of God instead of the wind. So what you have between 1917 and 1988 is, at least in the Jewish Publication Society, they've decided to adopt the Enuma Elish version, if you want to put it that way, of creation. That the world's already there. You know, when God set about creating, the earth was already without form and void. And the wind, a wind from God, was on the waters. So we don't have spirit of God. We don't have God pre-existent. Why did they translate it that way? I don't know. I don't know. But you can't deny the fact that it just happens to fit with all these other creation epics. Whereas, you know, centuries of translating, I want to say tradition, but I mean these were by experts, have it differently. So I guess it just shows me that you know, we live in a postmodern world. Yeah, go ahead, Brandon. They believe it does, because they don't believe that they believe like the assembly, at least of what the scriptures were, happened in Babylon, you know, in the captivity. So they're looking at the scriptures as only being centuries old, perhaps 5 centuries BC old, whereas the Enuma Elish is obviously much older. You know, we take some things on faith. We, you know, the first 5 books. We believe are a collection of older documents. So they, you know, they haven't found the older documents. So, yeah, obviously. Yeah. If you didn't hear Brandon, he's saying that the Enuma Elish and these other types of accounts are older. So that's why they say that the Bible's based on it. I don't see, to me, whether or not it's older, it's not similar. Yeah, it's older, but it's different. So why do they claim it should, that they're... that the Bible was taken from it, that I don't get. Personally, I don't get it. I'd like to spend a few minutes in Genesis. Because Christians themselves can battle back and forth about whether the earth is 6,000 years old or whether it's billions of years old, and whether the days were literal 24-hour periods of time or whether they were aeons, or, you know, whether this is symbolism or whether it's literal, and, you know, whether there was really an Adam and an Eve, and we can argue about all that stuff. And that's not the purpose of this talk. But I think there's a bigger issue. You know, why was Scripture written? Anybody want to answer that? Why do we have this book? Everybody think about that from a, you know, bigger perspective. Sometimes we get down to all these little details, but as I told you, I wanted to step back today and take a different view. Why do we have this book? Anybody want to give me their take on it? There's no right or wrong answer, I don't think. But why is there a Bible? Why do we have this? Go ahead.
I personally think it's God's revelation to mankind.
Okay. Anybody want to add to that? God's revelation of what?
Clothed, how to live.
Okay. Anything else? God's existence about himself. Okay. There's all kinds of things. What we see in the book of Genesis, well, let's just read it. Some of it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I got the King James here. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the waters, the face of the waters. This is qualitatively different from every creation account that I read through as I researched dozens of them, except for one. There was only one where somebody just out of their thought created the earth, or created something. All the other ones assume a preexistence. This one here says, in the beginning, there was God. And then he's the first cause, if you want to put it that way. It's because of him that everything else exists. The other creation accounts don't put it that way. That's very different. And I don't know that we in the Western world appreciate how different that is. But that, if you believe what this book says, you won't worship the creation, as Paul said they were doing in the first century in Greece and Rome. They were worshiping the creation, not the creator, because they had a polytheistic view of gods that fought each other, and that God didn't bring, there wasn't one God, and that one God didn't bring the universe into existence. But the Hebrew scriptures say that there was one God, and that God brought the universe into existence. Then we have, I don't want to go into details, you have 6 days worth of creation, where God is responsible for everything. He didn't react to what was there in a negative way, or, you know, he didn't fight with somebody else over it and toss something over his shoulder and up came people or whatever. You know, there were 6 days of creation that seemed to have a logic to them, even a parallel structure to them. You know, for you have light on the first day, then you've got lights in the heavens for seasons on the fourth day. The second day, you've got the seas. The fifth day, you've got life in the seas. The third day, you've got land. The sixth day, you've got life on the land. So you've got a parallels in there. Go ahead, Mike. Oh, okay. Good point. God said it was good. In these other accounts, they're fighting over things and it doesn't work out. And they have to try again, whatever. God, their God, the gods in these, the deities in the creation accounts I read and many, many, many others are not omnipotent, are not omniscient. They don't know everything. They're not all powerful. They're fighting with one another. They have secrets from one another. They're very human. Where the God we worship is not, obviously not human. Brandon.
Another one just came to mind. A lot of the Greek mythology and those kind of myths, people just have a lot of fear what the gods are introducing them. I think it might come from because there's no clear explanation of how these gods are being worshipped. But starting in the right at the beginning here, God says he created the stars, created the moon, created the sun, and all of those with the seasons. And, you know, he just started it right from the very beginning of how he wants to worship.
Okay, thank you. I mean, and if you listen, if you read through the stories, and they're fighting one another, and they can't agree among themselves. What if you're a human being trying to figure out how to please these guys? It's like, she don't know what they want. They don't know what they want. So how can you please them? Brandon's right. The book here, if you're people of the book, it's very clear what God expects. He makes it clear to us, which is a wonderful thing. One of the things you notice as you go through the first week here of creation is that what's last? Man. Man is created late on the sixth day, and everything else leads up to that. The earth is being prepared for man. This book is different from at least the creation accounts I looked at, in that man is the ultimate design of God's creative work. Everything else leads up to man. It's not an afterthought, not an accident. It's the purpose of everything else. That's different. And you know, in the Hebrew here, the in Genesis, it says God creates something after his own kind, after his own likeness. The other creation accounts, it's exactly the opposite, isn't it? Man has created his own gods in man's likeness, with man's foibles and man's problems and man's character. It's exactly the opposite. It's upside down. So man's created. We get more detail in the second chapter. And the gospel is preached right here in Genesis. Right here in the first book. That's another thing that's not true at all in the creation epics, because there's no message there, at least not to me. Whereas in Genesis, God creates man It's all very good. And by the time we get into the third chapter, we find out that it wasn't good anymore. Man rejected God's revelation and is put out of the garden. And I would say, what's the book for? I think one of the reasons that this book is written is to, in a figurative way, to tell us how to get back into the garden. We're kicked out. And what is salvation? What is redemption? It's restoration of the relationship with God. That's what the gospel is. How does it happen? It happens because our Savior died for us and makes it possible. But it's all here in the first three chapters of Genesis. The creation account is really an account of salvation. Why it's necessary, and at least a prophecy to how it was going to be fulfilled in, Genesis? You know where I'm talking about, that... he'll bruise his heel, but he'll tromp on his head or whatever it is. The prophecy, I'll put enmity between you and the woman, and between her seed and your seed, and it shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. The prophecy of Messiah. To me, that's all very different from any of those other accounts. Those other accounts are very human, very, very full of foibles, full of problems. This account shows that God created man. Man was very good. Man fell from grace, if you want to put it that way. Kicked out of the garden. God wants a relationship with man. He wants us back in the garden, figuratively. He wants us to he gives us access to the tree of life. And that's what salvation is all about. That's what the gospel is all about. We actually can, after being kicked out of the garden, God is now calling people to come back and be able to taste of the tree of life. That's all here. In three chapters in Genesis, in a nutshell. And it's a beautiful thing. So, I'm going to use a conclusion that's written by somebody named, I don't know what his name is. John Stevenson. And he wrote a little bit of a review about that Emmaus Elish, which I didn't read you the review, but I want to read his conclusion. There's a real difference between the Genesis account and the creation accounts of other pagan religions. In other religious systems, the natural world was seen as a manifestation of all of the deities, the sun, the moon, stars, oceans, storms. The cosmos has always had the status of deity. The Bible is unique in that the cosmos is merely creation. Only God is God.